and welcome to another edition of Men Matter. I'm Dr. Kevin McGuire, and I am thrilled to have with me tonight two exceptional people who are embarking on a project that I think has implications and value literally across the country, and certainly in certain areas it will be an eye-opener and, if not a beacon of light, certainly a direction for questions and for comfort. Let me welcome Melody Brooke and her husband Mike to the show. Good evening.
Good evening. Hey.
Quick introduction here. Melody is, with regard to the long list of her qualifications, let's stay with, well, knock it down to three, which I think today are the very most important and on the top. A counselor for many years, actor, and screenwriter involved with the current production, and her co-writer, co-director, and part inspiration, if not direct inspiration, with applicability to the film, Mike. Is that benign but correct?
Yes.
Well, Melody, let's start with you if we can.
Okay.
We spoke the other day about your background, about counseling, and how that drew you to this and gave you quite a big base of information. Talk a little bit, as much as you'd like, about how you came this far and your experience in using those events. And
I've been a counselor for more than 20 years, and I've worked with adolescents and adults and couples, and worked with people who have trauma, people who have normal life traumas, and people have extraordinary life traumas. But one of the consistent themes that I've seen is difficulties with their relationship with their dad as causing so much pain and so much dysfunction in their life. And so it was sort of a natural progression for me to go from, working with clients with that issue, and then realizing that I needed to reach a wider audience than I was able to reach just in my practice,
Right. And did that, at the time you were doing the counseling, did you feel like certain chords were being struck? Did this somehow echo or resonate in you that later on you suddenly reached a tipping point and said, I've got to do something here?
Well, what's happened, of course, is that I myself had my own father issues. My own father was not available to me for a variety of reasons, and had my own father issues, and recognized that as a theme in my life that I've had to deal with. And then, of course, part of that, the impact of that, is that I've had a difficult time in my own relationships, and I've been divorced twice. And then I'm very fortunate to have met my current husband, Mike, and discovering how different it is when a person is knows how to be a present, available dad, and to see that with his children, to see that how he is, and how the impact that has on his kids.
With that in mind, how did you choose film as a medium for collating all this and making it a presentation en masse, if you will, of counseling, sort of drawing on everything? How did film come across your
desk? Well, it's kind of funny because back when I first went to school back in back in the day, I went to school and got my degree in theater and came to Dallas and became an actor here and taught acting. And then when my first child was born, I continued to do acting. But then when my twins were born, I kind of had my hands full and I had to find a different career to get me through, their youth. And so I became a counselor, and through working with the clients that I worked with, which is I worked with a very intense population of clients who had what used to be called multiple personality disorder and is now called dissociative identity disorder. And basically, those are people who had a whole lot of trauma in their life. Well, I wrote a book, a couple of books, and what I discovered after writing my books was that very few people actually read them.
I'm appalled.
Yeah, and I had things to say, and I knew it was important. The things that I have to say are important, and people need to know them. And so I was sort of dismayed that even when I could get the book sold, which is a struggle in itself, right, to find people, to find an outlet to sell them.
Right.
But even when they bought them, they wouldn't read them. And so I started thinking, well, what would be a better way to get my message across? And so I had that kind of going in the back of my mind. Well, then once my kids got out of high school and off to college, I started back into my old career and started acting again. And then as I was, you know, acting and working in film and enjoying that medium a lot, it occurred to me that writing a screenplay would be a much more powerful way to get my message across, and would reach people. People would actually go to a theater and sit all the way through it if it was a good film, right?
True. And I think missing anymore is film that makes you think.
Well, yeah, and films that are character driven, that are story driven, that are not just about the action and the violence and the sex and whatever. You know, they really are a story that really pulls you into the story, into the characters, and then you can really get moved by the story.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, this conversation came up the other day. Some friends had taken their teenagers off to the latest Transformers movie. I don't know any Transformers personally, so I really can't get fired up about it. But when I read your description, when you went through the project, particularly we spoke in on the website, it's not, I think it has the benefit of being not just a singular approach, but this is three cases. You outline and you go through three separate things. It's got to strike a chord. Mike, does that hit with you as well? This is, fathers seem to have been pigeonholed. And when you tell a story about a dad, I think the extrapolation to the whole sometimes goes too far. This is three fathers. How'd that come about as being the best way for you guys?
It started off as three guys, and the story went from there. We had three, general cases of fathers who've been through this. And we came up with a story and came up with all these, and we toned them down because the truth of what happened to our three prototypes is so much beyond what we could get by with in the movie, because people wouldn't believe it. At least that's what we thought. And then we get to talking to people about this, and almost everybody knows the case is bad or worse as the ones these are based on. And the funny thing about that is that, well, everybody personally knows this goes on socially and culturally, and in the media, we don't seem to have any awareness of it.
That's true, and I think that's why I really applaud this, and I'm so looking forward to this. And I was actually looking down the list of how I want to get involved. I don't know if I want the signing, screenplay, or the. I'm really looking at this outgoing voice message thing.
Yeah, we're hoping you'll pick the one where we fly to where you are, because we'd love to come visit you.
Hey, there you go. We can go fishing. Yeah, there you go. I think you hit on a couple of big nerves, and probably the biggest one as I've gotten involved with this show is, yeah, people do know, or they hear whispers of, or they do a lot of, oh, that's a shame, but that's as far as it gets. It never leaves the coffee table or the dinner or the ride in the car with someone, and it, with rare exception, it's not put for the number of people, families, children, for the horrors, and I'm using that word correctly, that go across this spectrum, it never makes the television or the radio or the media to the degree that it's seen as what it is, and ongoing and worsening and long-term ripple effect that seems to be, if you will, turn a blind eye by those who could, at a large level, politically, legally, et cetera, do something.
It's a whole attitude, and it's not even just about where we focus on fathers, it's on men in general. If you look at commercials, you'll see how often, women can be violent and men can get hit, and that's okay.
Not only is it okay, it's funny, right?
It's funny, right. It's funny when men get hit. It's funny when, in comedy shows, when they're constantly ripping the father, and it, you know, and he laughs, ha ha ha, I got to put up with this. But if you did the same thing to the mother, it would be appalling. And it's kind of, well, why is that? And that's one of the questions we like to address.
That dichotomy has come across with so many of the people I've interviewed and the folks that they've had experiences with. I don't know, and the more I read, the more I hear, the more experience I have, I don't know how this could have gone under the radar.
Well, here's what I think, okay, is that women, because we have fought so hard to get rights in so many ways, and we've been discriminated against in so many ways, that we forgot that the point is not to be dominant, but to be equal.
To share.
Right. I had a guest one time say that once women got, quote, in the game, that a tie was no longer acceptable.
Yes. Yeah.
And sort of getting back at the other team for keeping things unequal for so long, it was approached more as a pendulum. Okay, we'll get back to the center, but let's fly out to the other side like those guys were, and then we'll come back at some later date. But right now, I want to be in the other side where those guys were. And that's a shame. I could perhaps understand it, but
It's not just a shame. It costs us. It costs us as women to have that happen. Because as a result, we don't have a partner to share childcare with. We don't have somebody that we can count on to be a partner in our lives, because we've really pushed them out of that role.
I agree, Melody. I think part of this has been an unforeseen detriment in trying to not so much garner equality, but somehow go past it to a sense of get evenness. Now, I don't think that applies at the particular level, but it's wound its way into political, legislative, legal. Here I reference things like the Violence Against Women Act, which so many people, while you can applaud the safety intent, it has become a pariah and produced the exact opposite. The sort of must-arrest clause in so many localities.
Yes.
I think it puts men and women and families on this precipice.
Yes.
Where the system is just daring you to push yourselves off.
Well, and it gives women an avenue for their anger, that is not warranted. It makes it so easy for them to throw out the abuse card and have their husband have to go through the nightmare of being arrested and going through the trial and, all of that unnecessarily in some cases.
And the attendant effects on friends and family members
and the children
particularly, because they're caught literally in the middle and I think deliberately placed there by the system itself.
Yes.
It profits from them.
It is an industry with tentacles literally everywhere we go.
Yes.
There's no end to the downstream revenue, as a friend of mine once called this system. The downstream revenue surrounding all of the, what he calls the system's invasion into families and marriages. And it's limitless. Limitless and bounded only by your imagination of accusation or, quote, repair or evaluation. I'm divorced and have a similar circumstance with many zeros behind a number, only to, when it comes down to it, that's what this was all about. Nothing.
The professionals involved benefit financially from inciting an adversarial, incendiary relationship.
I agree more. I couldn't agree more. This is just me talking. I literally get hives using the word professional with some of the people connected to these circumstances.
Yes.
A professional would not act in that manner. An ethical provider of physical or mental or social care would disdain any thought that they might be connected or involved or contributory to this. But too often it's unwitting. You're the last in the line or the next, or you try and fix it only to find out that it has, and as you stated, it starts off perhaps using men as the entryway, but it goes viral, to use a current...
Well, part of the problem is that we as a culture, perhaps even as human beings, have to perceive the world from a perspective of who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, who's the victim, right? And
true.
When we have that blame game that we engage in, then there has to be someone that becomes the bad guy. And it doesn't make any difference whether it's true or not. There just has to be somebody that is the bad guy and somebody else that's the victim. And in most cases in our culture, we think of women as the victim. We always expect the woman to be a victim. We don't see the woman as the bad guy, the perpetrator. We see her as the victim.
That lends a lot of legal, political system weight,
yes.
Which perhaps that's the wrong word, momentum.
Yes.
Once that ball starts rolling, I'm reminded of the scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where Indiana Jones turns around and there's that. All he did was pick up this little thing and suddenly here's this giant, unstoppable ball and there's no way out. You have to just go out and take your chances, just jump in the air. And waiting outside, as I now like to say, are members of social services, mental health, the police, the court. They're all sitting around with their spears going, got him.
And as women, we're sort of raised to think of ourselves that way, which means we are disempowered. We don't really know the power that we have. We think that we're powerless. We perceive ourselves as being the victim instead of recognizing that we do have power in these situations. And there are things that we can and do that make the situation better or worse.
I agree. I think one of the things there is that this is also, I believe, becoming ingrained or, if you will, a culture of, or a mindset of children, then young women, then women who are brought up in this aura of, oh, I need to be protected, I'm weak. And for me, I think it's backlashed into a sense of, rather than having self-empowerment, self-reliance, it turns women to look outside themselves once again for virtually everything.
Yes.
I think that's a dangerous well-established trend now.
And it's part of what pulls them into the system because they expect these authority people to have the last word and to be correct and right in what they're doing and gives them a sense of that they're justified in their feelings because this professional person is saying this is how it is. And that's part of how they get sucked into the system that eggs on this damaging relationship with their partner.
It is the system takes advantage of the custodial parent as much as the non-custodial. They're, they're both sources of power for the players and sources of revenue, and that's the political system.
I agree, and it really has become a game of extraction. How much can we get from one to give to the other, siphon off our share, maintain a political, legal separation so that now we can have an agency or a group step in, and suddenly we are nanny state families.
Yes.
But except it's more like being nanny state prisoners.
Yes.
I think. Well, in that regard, can you talk a little bit about how some of this, maybe the specifics we just talked about, pick one of these that you might briefly talk about without giving away the whole thing as a, what's your favorite? How's that? I guess that's the wrong question to ask. I didn't mean to tie you to that, but pick one that you like a lot. And say, this is a good example of this particular aspect of things.
In terms of telling one of the stories about how they work?
Pick a story and say, we use this one to highlight this particular concept. Or we think this is a good example of.
Well, one really good example is our character, John, who a very unconnected emotionally kind of a guy who married a girl who provided him with unlimited sex. So he was very happy until he found out that she was providing unlimited sex to a lot of other people in order to feed her drug habit. And but at that point, he had two kids.
One of which wasn't his. But.
And he didn't really realize it at the time. But once he figured that out, he still had to pay child support for that child.
Well, it got worse than that, actually. I mean, at one point, she's going to the place and telling him that this fella is a drug addict. So they go into his house and start ripping out the walls. And so they decide, okay, he's not really a drug dealer. And then one of my favorite stories is that they were keeping the kids in the house. And so the parents would switch houses every week. And so this guy decided it'd be a good idea to, you know, bug the place and record what was going on. So he has a record of a tape recording of the social worker sitting down on the couch, smoking a joint with his wife, talking about all this stuff. And when that got out in court, they ended up suing this guy for and getting a judgment of $65,000 against him, which I'm pretty sure all went to drugs. Because these kids never had the same address for 6 months in their entire life. They lived on the street. I never went to college, hardly ever went to school. It's, you know, that was the choice of a judge. He said it's more important that he be with the mother than with the father, or a father who did everything he could. Actually, kidnapped him at one point, took him across the country to get him away, but that wasn't sustainable.
That didn't work too well because they ended up losing all contact with him.
Yeah, so.
And I think that those highlights, like you're saying, you brought it up in the beginning, and I think it's true. I know it personally to be true, and from many, many people I've talked to and folks I've interviewed, it really is unbelievable to the average person.
Oh yeah, I mean,
it
and
just
I,
exceeds reality.
Well, I have a daughter who is an attorney. She's a wonderfully
naive,
but she's brilliant, and you know, but she's just a new attorney, and she really. Every time we talk about this stuff, she just can't even believe it. She doesn't even believe it's true, you know. It just goes against what we believe about our country and about our legal system.
And that brings up a question. Given what we tend to think, or perhaps maybe we'd like to think of, the courts and the legal system and all the great houses of law and education and all the TV shows, and, you know, they're just folks.
Yeah.
And in retrospect to all of those shows, while they may certainly have given some grandeur to them, and it's done for every walk of life, it seems, on television, at the end of the day, I guess the best way to say it is these people put their pants on one leg at a time.
Yeah.
And it would shock most people to know that they're just in the same line at Costco as they are. There's no throne that I have ever heard of being issued, but we treat it like that.
It is really a big thing. We like to have faith in institutions and people in power, and that sucks. And you can imagine, you're just stick on women here. Women, you're a mother, you've got these two kids, you're going through this divorce, it's not worked out, your whole world is shattered, everything you plan on have ever wanted is gone, all your dreams. You got these kids, you're mad as hell about that, you're mad at this person, and now this guy who comes in with a very sharp-looking suit and is telling you, well, this is what you do and how you go about it, and you're angry, and he's basically handing you a hammer and saying, go, that's pretty irresistible, especially when all your friends are egging you on.
Yeah, it is, and they stand ready to accept, I think, too quickly. That what the system is about to do is to destroy a family and then place the burden on the children.
Yes.
Almost universally.
Which is their only interest is the well-being of the children, which is always their favorite joke, right?
Yeah.
It can't be defined. No one's ever seen it. There's no book on it, so to speak. But the, quote, best interest standards.
We know this ain't it.
It rings too much like the old expression, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you.
Right. Well, and, you know, the ridiculous thing is that all, you know, all across the board, all of the studies show that by far the best interest of the child is whenever possible to be in joint custodial relationship with their parents.
Here, here.
So 50-50 custody is what is in the best interest of the child, and that all of the studies show that, and yet very, very few of the courts reflect that.
And that is a point that so many people have made, and I am increasingly getting involved in, and that is, if just looking out over the great expanse outside the courthouse, a judge says, oh, look at all those folks out there, and we're watching their rights, and we're helping them. No one is randomly entering homes, at least not yet, and saying, we're here to do your yearly family checkup.
Right.
We're from the Institute of We Know Better.
Oh, that's scary.
And who knows?
Because we know they don't know better. There's no way they could.
Right. But they look out and think, well, there's a lot of happy people out there, and they're doing this, and it's because of our protecting their rights. Why does that thought not even in their own minds extend to coming to court and saying, you know, we had no problem with you guys as a family before you came in here. No one questioned your parenting, et cetera. If it did, we have to bring that up. But I'm very, very much now in favor of, if not certainly at the state and perhaps even at the federal level, I think it's imperative for families, for kids. There's got to be a shared parenting standard. You walk in 50-50. You're equal. Now, prove to me or disprove this other person's fitness, et cetera. It would really eliminate people going in. There'd be fewer battles. And the cost is excruciating. Somebody has to pay for all that court time.
Well, it's excruciating and more than just financially. It's excruciating. The cost is with the kids. The kids, they pay the cost.
They do. They wind up, and we both know this. You know this as well, more than me. They later on have problems, self-esteem, blaming, guilt. Was it my fault? If you've seen any of them over the course of your practice, you know that as young adults, or even adults, they'll walk in and go, I still wonder if I, blah, blah, you know.
And they struggle with their ability to maintain healthy relationships because they don't have that ability to connect with one parent or another. You know, they're alienated from one parent. And when you have that, it's very difficult then to maintain good marital connections, relationship connections later in life.
Clearly, and almost unspoken and unrecognized item in the courts. You very rarely hear that come up. It's very infrequently written in articles about it. But there's been, at least recently, some measure of judicial articles, legal articles, to bring up the topic of, we can congeal it down perhaps to parental alienation.
Yeah.
Or I think that it's universal to a degree, whether it's unintended or even a little spit for spat, that type thing, all the way up to the level where if you see of any Warshak's work or Amy Baker, it's abuse at a certain point, which should be treated as that.
Yes, I agree, because it's abusive to the child, if nothing else. I mean, because what happens is that the child then, because they know they are of both parents, right? And every time that their parent badmouths their other parent, they feel shame. They feel shamed by it.
They want to naturally express their feelings, but they are exacted a psychological punishment for doing that.
Yeah.
And that's the big picture, I think I read that somewhere, about 10% of all the cases that go to social services, et cetera, are deemed emotional abuse. But they account for less than 0.01% of prosecutions of abuse in the country.
Wow.
So you've got about a 10,000-to-1 chance of getting away with severe parental alienation. Criminal, abusive, child abuse by the standards of the state and even the CDC. Want to interest yourself in something if you do part two of this? Pick up some of the literature, even from the CDC, on child abuse. There's a booklet called The Child Maltreatment Survey. included in there are even the things that might seem innocuous but should be viewed as detrimental to kids, including acts against possessions or personal items which remind the child of the other parent.
Yeah.
That's excruciating to children. So often they have the toy or the picture, et cetera. I'll digress here for a second and give you perhaps, at least from what I've seen and heard, probably the most egregious but specific example, as you said, of vilifying one parent by the outside forces. At a case, we'll just say within the past 10 years, a therapist testified in court under oath that the father's mother, the grandmother, should not see her own grandchildren because the family resemblance between the mother and the son might induce a problem that the therapist would have to deal with, and it would slow down getting the dad and the kids back together. This so-called family facial resemblance syndrome, as I've labeled it, is actually, if you like, I'll send you the transcript.
That's just so absurd.
And the judge bought it, and the grandmother could only see her kids in the office of this same therapist for $70 an hour to look for effects of unbelievable. And that sort of absurdity passes for scholarly thought.
Yeah, that's absurd.
Well, and part of the problem is you've got gullible judges who want to get things off their docket. The courts don't want to deal with this stuff because it is so hard to know.
It's murky.
Well, it's impossible for them to know what the right choice is. It really is. So they don't want to deal with it. Instead, they trust the social workers and the lawyers and these people to tell them what's really going
and
on.
And the PhD is doing the family assessment.
Yeah, which we won't even go there. But
yeah, and that of course lends it to what I think is the big draw for a lot of people. They make a lot of money.
A lot of money off of it.
Oh my gosh! If I'd have known, and this is a real number.
Yes.
A case where a guy had to do this, get back with the kids, quote, therapy, where they were playing board games or Monopoly. One of the therapists was charging $187 an hour to watch the dad play Monopoly with each of his kids. 3 hours, and sometimes not even that, I'm guessing, whatever the number was. So imagine a $500 a day Monopoly watching job. And where was this when I was at my high school guidance counselor's office?
Well, and here's the thing too. You know, these experts that the court hires to do the family assessment, as the person going to court, generally the father is the defendant and has to pay for this. Mandatory, no options given, and they have to pay. And it's normally anywhere between $4,000 and $10,000.
Would that it was only that. I know of a guy who spent well over $100,000 for a single assessment.
Well, and they go in and they spend 4 hours with the guy, and he might come and spend 3 hours with the family at once. And for that, they make, anywhere from, $5,000 to $100,000.
And perhaps something to think about, and certainly I think you're hitting on all the things here. Thank God you're a counselor with the experience from how this has affected people. And you may know this, correct me if I'm wrong, but the majority of psychological testing is done as a means of helping someone identify a fault or an area or an improvement or some means of saying, here's an area we need to look at, rather than the way I think they're treated now, like everyone should simply go through the looking glass of the MMPI and pop out cured.
You want to hear the real absurdity?
I can't imagine it gets worse, but hold on. Okay, go.
Here's the real absurdity. The MMPI, which is what is given generally by these psychologists who are running these family assessments, okay? The MMPI is designed for one purpose. One purpose.
And okay, I'm ready.
That purpose is to determine mental illness. where a person is mentally ill. In other words, for the normal population, it has no value whatsoever.
And then it's, so what would be the reason for having the universal application of this to?
Because they can.
They can. And then my experience is that this is a standardized test that's supposed to be graded by a standardized, you know, you're supposed to send it back to the whoever sells the test.
Well, it's a computer that does it.
My experience is they just grade them themselves.
And sometimes they can grade them themselves.
And
there's also
however
programs.
They want to.
Yeah. But they can grade it themselves. But in any case, it is really just for the outliers, the extreme mental illness like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or, you know, something like that. That is what it is to determine. It is not to be used for any other reason, and yet it is across the board used in these cases.
In other words, they're using a test designed to find abnormalities.
Yes.
In a population which is no reason to be thought of as abnormal.
Yes.
Or put in another way, if we find something, we can get you to pay for it.
Yes.
Or if we interpret it as something.
Exactly. If you interpret it as such.
It's more like giving someone one of these tests, you know, the ELISA test, which it tests for some presence of something in your body. You've been exposed to antibodies or whatever. And then extrapolating that to mean something else. All it tests for is this one thing, yet they're deciding that it means these other things.
That's exactly what's happening.
And so you've got people who've got, you know, dissertations written on how to use this test, and nobody cares. They just go off and use it however they want to. But because it's a standardized test, they think it has credibility. It's just being used in a non-standard way, so it's no longer a standard test.
And Melanie, and you could certainly address this, but isn't it true that the really well-ingrained, say, borderline or some other typical chameleon-like personality can walk through these and come out the other end?
Well, actually, the NMPI is designed to catch that.
Not in our experience.
But it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't always. That's right. It doesn't always.
So then the end result then is, you go into court, all this is done, the evaluator, the custody evaluator, whoever, does all these testing materials, and then decides, I think there's a trace of X or Y, and, you know, and this could have import for the kids because dad or mom is a little too, you know, they X or B, or, there's something, and that becomes the scratch on the beaker, as we used to say in chemistry, and all of a sudden you get this reaction. Oh, okay, so therapy for everybody, and you're down the road to, at least everything I've read and seen and had happen, you're grooming, particularly children, as lifelong abnormalities in their own minds.
The very frustrating thing to me as a family therapist is that there are tests that are available that they can give to the family to determine family functioning that are much more valuable than an MMPI, and that's not what they use.
But even if it was, you know, that just because you don't score well on a test doesn't have anything to do with A, your importance of being in your child's life, or your competence as a parent. I think, you know, my ex, I don't see how you could possibly justify not wanting to keep her in their lives. But the way things have gone, it's been just a disaster because she was the only person in their lives. So I don't think you should use these to exclude parents, you know, unless they're really, really, really severely messed up.
Yeah.
And, of course, the downside to that is that you'll be met with the attorney – like the divorce industry axis, if you will, saying, well, then how are we supposed to know?
And so you have to assume that until there's good evidence that they're doing damage, that it's probably the best thing to let it be. Too often, even when you've got what all of us would judge as not a good person necessarily as the parent, you take it out of a child's life and you do an enormous amount of damage.
You know,
more than a parent would have.
Yeah, and you know, the funny thing is, when you talk about that, is I'm reminded of the time when I worked in the foster care system. And working in the foster care system, you know, I was seeing kids being pulled out of their abusive homes and put into foster care situations. And what I observed was that was more damaging than leaving the child in the abusive home, for the most part.
Psychologically more of a danger.
Yeah.
Which, of course, leads to the next step. How do you undo this?
Well, I think you have to start with raising awareness, which is why we made the film in the first place, was that we want people, we're trying to get the film made, is because we want people to start to think differently about things. And it really comes down to the families themselves protesting and saying, no, we don't want to live like this anymore. We don't want this for our children. And people starting to change how they accept things, that they stop accepting things, the status quo, and demanding that things be different. That's how things change.
And for me, I think it has a two-pronged approach. One is to have, as you say, a general awareness, not just the folks who, as we talked about here, you know, you trade your stories over coffee or in the car, but like what you're doing, get something out that the average person will look at and say, I know a guy like that. Or, you know, someone, you know, and the other is having that to then take it to the next step.
But
go do something.
Everybody knows the guy. I'm surprised to find this out, but almost everybody knows a guy like this. It's on a personal level, we all know this, but it's socially, culturally, in the media, what we see in front of us and presented to us of how the world is doesn't acknowledge that this is what's going on. And I think it has to be something done in the media, culturally, in front of us to begin to change our social perception, not our personal perception.
This I had a discussion with someone years ago, and I'm sure I heard it somewhere, but I said, you know, this literally is, as so many have said, this is a war on fathers.
It is.
It's no less than a war because there are casualties and suicides and deaths.
Yes.
And destruction of families and money, whole areas of society cast adrift, that would be children.
And destroying fathers does not help the child. It destroys the child.
Even if people don't want to be that specific, I would agree 100% that that's the base of it. But to take it into the larger venue where so many people feel they have to address things, this is not good for society. And I don't think you have to look too far to see where we're at.
I mean, absolutely. When you look at the growing number of single families and single parent families, and when there's not a father that's involved in that single parent family, there's often poverty and violence and drug abuse and, you know, acting out of all in all levels of society.
And the exclusion of, even in families where one or the other party may remarry, completely excluding that parent and that portion of that family history from a child is equally horrible. They grow up thinking, certainly they must ask themselves, and you probably see this, was I abandoned? What's wrong with me that a whole group of people just cleaved off my life, a whole family of aunts, uncles, cousins, they're gone. Maybe mom or dad, whoever is right. Oh, yeah, they're
And I have to say that, you know, my own situation was that my parents divorced when I was 2, and my mother maintained a level of rage toward my father my whole life, and I was able to see him. I mean, he had rights to see me and stuff, but I think she made it so uncomfortable for him that was difficult for him to do.
And I can tell you, even from my own experience, that you have to sometimes weigh what the other parent is going to do if you try to reestablish a level that you think should be there, and how much it's going to cost them psychologically, the children, to have to put up with something that you will be unable to control afterwards.
Right.
And as kids get older and they get into their teens, they start getting a little natural rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And so that independence, which comes about, I think that's the time to foster a reestablishment. But when kids are little, it's a brutal thing to have these things happen. There was one guy sent me an email that he is, I think it was his ex's sister or something like that, had been instructing the kids to throw out cards and throw out presents, to rehearse saying, you know, stop doing this, stop calling, don't come to the football game, and just because that got them kudos back at mom's.
Right.
And it was the only psychological help they had. The only psychological reward was kind of like it's almost a gang theory, you know, go do this bad thing and we'll like you. I'm not sure if that's palatable for people to even look at.
But that happens on such a, can happen on such a, I mean, that's a very direct level, but can happen on a very indirect level as well. So that it's less spoken than it is unspoken, and only from an emotional sort of response, right? You know what I'm saying? Very
exactly.
Subtle. And it can happen very, very subtly. I know that, you know, my mom really, really, it was really, really important to her that we loved her. And that if we showed that we loved him, it was a threat to her.
Right. Hence, the emotional abusive aspect of this.
Yeah. And I don't think my mom at all would have done that deliberately. You know, she didn't do that deliberately. That was just because of her own needs, her own psychological needs.
And that I think is how it starts. And then it becomes an effective tool for some people to use that in a very abusive and direct manner. If I do this, I can poison the well. So we kind of hit on a lot of stuff here, parental alienation, the war on men, the destruction of, if you will, the equality has become a sort of a race to the top.
Yeah.
Of which, of course, someone generally falls down, and at this time it's hard to stop the momentum, I think, from this going on, other than at some very large grassroots or political level. We got about 10 minutes left here. A question I wanted to ask is, within each of these stories, is there a subtlety beyond what we might see as the message that we're going to get very cleanly? Are these stories that we should go back and maybe watch this again and watch it the third time and go, oh, I got it. I get it.
We have so much happening in this film, and we hit so many notes in this film that it's not just about, you know, dads and their kids. It's not just about, you know, the struggle that women have against their husbands. I mean, it's so many things. And one of the notes is, really, what is it that drives women to be the way they are, you know, and having compassion for how they are and how they've gotten thrown into this system themselves?
It's a really important thing to not sit here and pick sides, even though the other side's picking up clubs to hit you with it, because your kids are involved. And once you fall into the fight, your value to your kids is, you know, severely diminished. And that's all you can do is not get engaged. I know some people manage to win, but most of them don't. You just have to. And so what our movie does is it talks about trying to get some understanding of both sides of what's going on, why people do the things they do. Plus, the movie is fun.
Yeah, it's fun. Mike is very witty, so we have a lot of wit in it.
You know, the point is to make it entertaining, because if it's not entertaining, the experience won't settle in that, hey, you know what, let's look at these men, let's see these men differently. Let's not just see them running around with Uzis in their hands or doing this or that or the other thing. Some of the revelations come from some rather surprising places that you're going to think we made up, but we stole them from real life because we couldn't make that stuff up.
And that's a good point. I wanted to ask you about that. Hopefully, viewers will say, oh, that could never happen. That's a, these people are trying to sell this. This is a moot. This is so much.
We toned it down.
Yeah, we did.
Even within that, though, someone's going to say, oh, that'll never happen. And then 2 weeks later, they'll talk to someone about this movie and they'll say, oh, yeah, that happened to so-and-so. No, go.
You know, everyone that we've spoken with has knows somebody who's had a similar experience. And, you know, the amazing thing to me, Kevin, is that women get behind this so strongly because they see it too.
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. I've spoken with so many women who are just vehement in their opposition to the way the world is twisting against men, fathers, and I think you brought up what I see as a very important point. Women are really one of the most affected groups in this, quote, war on fathers, war on men. Yeah. I think, let me give you the class. Someone who's willing to stand up like yourself and say, you know, this is bad for marriage, for relationships, for family, for natural order of things, and I'm sure I'll get heat for that. The thought that you do want to curl up or be with or have an established relationship is excruciatingly important, not individually only, but as a species. Wow, to have someone, have a woman like yourself, stand up and say, hey, this is bad for women. Wake up. We're going down the wrong road. I couldn't give you any more kudos if I tried.
They've seen it cost their fathers. They've seen it cost their brothers. And they've seen it cost their
husbands,
children.
Their husbands.
But they've also seen it cost themselves because they realize they can't have the relationship they want until they start seeing men differently.
And Melody, I think you hit on a good point, and it's one that I've looked at and been shocked that no one pays more attention to. For our daughters who are 10, 15, X number of years away, to have them thrown into this system with this bias, with this prejudice, with this attitude, I don't want my daughters to have to deal with a mindset like that in society. How terrible.
Yeah.
How terrible. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. And to have them thrust into that as a good luck.
Well, and what happens, of course, is that, and I'm sure this is not news to you, but is that girls who have an alienated relationship with their father end up having all kinds of issues with their own self-esteem, with their ability to connect with men, and they crave male attention and affection, and they end up acting out in some terrible ways, you know, like this large growing tendency of girls to do sexting.
Oh.
You know that, and it's girls that drive that. It's not the boys. I mean, our gut reflex is to think it's the boys, but it's really the girls that drive it. They're the ones that, as you know, 10, 12, 13 years old, they're the ones that are sending the sexting messages to the boys because they are in such need of affirmation and validation from the opposite sex.
Again, what an insight, and I think too few people are willing to hear it, much less take any action on it.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming near the end here. I did want to give you some time. I think it's important. Website, Kickstarter, things we spoke about before. Take some time and please put that out there for the listeners.
Okay. Well, the website is thatsnothowitsdone.com. And you click on, at the top of the page, there's a yellow button that you click on to be able to see the trailer, and it will take you to the Kickstarter page where you have an opportunity to donate at any level from $5 up to $10,000 or more.
And the cool thing about Kickstarters is we need a certain amount of money to be able to make the film. And if enough people don't donate, then we don't ever get the money that never comes out of their account. So it's really pretty risk-free. It's not like you're throwing it there, and if it doesn't get finished, what happens to it? Well, it never comes out of your account. Until we reach enough money that you know the movie's going to be made, which is a really cool thing about Kickstarter, is a way to gather money.
And even if you don't feel like you can donate financially, if you can just send a message out to everyone that you know through your social networks, through your family, through your email lists, whatever, to pass the word along so that we can get this thing funded so we can actually make this film and get it out there to on a theatrical release so people can see it and learn.
Now hopefully it'll be an entertaining chance for people to get a different view of men, and that's really what this is all about.
And if you want to talk to me, if you want to talk to Mike, you can email us at info@thatsnothowitsdone.com. So we'd be happy to talk to you about other ideas that you might have about how we could promote this.
Excellent. I'm thrilled. This was such a pleasant interview. I was so happy to hear from you guys. We could probably talk all day.
Probably.
And on that, let me make an invite here. Perhaps we could pick a time in the not-too-distant future, pick a topic, a specific, maybe not for an hour, maybe 30 minutes, because with what the film is doing, and pick that as close as we can to the bone for both identifying and how we can get solutions. We can even take call-ins here, so we'll have to think about maybe getting a limited audience call-in, maybe 15, 20 minutes or something like that of a topic, and then would you think that might be something you'd like to?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I'm sure the movie, once it's out, and I'm sure it will be great. And just so I'm clear now, someone who contributes to Kickstarter puts in X, unless it's all or none. If it doesn't get to the total, then no dance.
Right.
And if we get more than the total, then that lets us bring in some more bigger name Hollywood actors. It's kind of amazing who will work on a movie like this if you can get them a ticket and hotel and pay them a little bit.
Wow. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, certainly. And it's a small world out there in film, I'm guessing. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing.
Yeah. And we would like that to happen. You know, we'd like to get a couple of stars behind it to make it get some legs.
Wow. I'm thrilled. I know this is going to go. This is great. I've been psyched to have you guys here. What a great effort, and I couldn't possibly be more thrilled that this is going to go out in a manner that really addresses the problem at the level it affects people, not just the platitudes we get from people further up the line. So,
thank you. That's what we're hoping. That's our plan.
I'm fired up for it, and I kind of know a lot about it, so I'm sure people who are really out there thinking, I wonder, I'll go see this, might find themselves more involved. Thank you so much. Our hour's about up here. Anything you want to add? We've got another minute or so. I think we...
Just, you know, to know that if you're a dad who's out there, you know, struggling with these issues, to know that you're not alone, that there are... there's a whole network of other people out there who've been through it, and to know that there is hope because there are people out here like me who want to make it be different.
There we go. I couldn't agree more. Groups like Fathers and Families, American Coalition for Fathers and Children. Certainly look up if you're in a parental alienation mode, look at that. Read. There are good authors. People like Melody who have done a lot of experience, looked at this from not just the tabletop angle. What happens years later is almost always more important than what's happening now.
So, yes.
Thank you again so much. This has been a pleasure. I'm exhilarated.
Thank you. And please do let us know when you want to have us on again.
I will. And we'll pick a time and we'll do some topic talk. And I think it'll be great.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And we'll... talk again soon.
Okay, great.
All right, well, this is another edition of Men Matter on our show tonight. Our wonderful guests, Melody and Mike Brook. This has been a discussion of the film aspects of bringing awareness to fathers and a much overdue application of this medium to help everyone involved. Thank you again, and I'll say good night from here. Good night, Melody. Good night, Mike.
Thank you. Appreciate it.